might have negatively affected my self-esteem. So, we're going to read a verse from Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita as it is, which Srila Prabhupada presented to us. And we're going to read a verse from chapter 10, chapter 10, text 9, which describes, in a sense, what we are doing now. In Sanskrit, the common term for this would be satsanga. You may have heard that term, satsanga. Sangha means association, and sat among those who are, you could say, spiritually minded, among those who are concerned with understanding higher truth and not only lower truth. I remember when I was at Harvard, I would go from Cambridge over to Boston to visit the Krishna temple there. And the bridge that goes between the cross of the Charles River that goes from Cambridge to Boston, the one that goes right into Harvard Square, has an old plaque on it. There's all this wisdom in America written on buildings and plaques. They would never do it nowadays because it's seeming to violate something, but they used to do it. And so on this old bridge, there's a sign that says, "The community of the wise is the welfare of the world." Community of the wise is the welfare of the world. So that's the idea of satsanga. Not this Bhagavad Gita, but the Bhagavatam, which is our main text, or largest text, it is the result of a conversation, a discussion that was held thousands of years ago in a sacred forest in India called Nainisha. Nainisha Aranya. Aranya means forest. So Nainisha forest. And thousands of years ago, very wise people gathered together and talked to each other about what could be done. What could be done about the state of the world? And how could they themselves achieve spiritual perfection? So, thousands of years later, in Tucson, Arizona, here we are, and we're talking. So, this verse that we're going to read tonight discusses that, this activity of satsanga. This is 10.9.gita. So the Sanskrit is machitta madgata prana bodhiyanta parasparam katayantascha mam nityam tushanti charananti cha. So I'll read Prabhupada's translation and then purport and then we'll discuss this. Prabhupada writes, "The thoughts of my pure devotees dwell in me. Their lives are fully devoted to my service. They derive great satisfaction and bliss, always enlightening one another and conversing about me." Prabhupada writes, "Pure devotees, whose characteristics are mentioned here, engage themselves fully in the transcendental loving service of the Lord." Okay. Not as simple as it looks, is it? There we go. So, their minds cannot be diverted from Krishna's lotus feet. Their talks are solely on the transcendental subjects. The symptoms of the pure devotees are described in this verse specifically. Devotees of the Supreme Lord are 24 hours daily engaged in glorifying the Supreme Lord's qualities and pastimes. Their hearts and souls are constantly submerged in Krishna. And they take pleasure in discussing him with other devotees. So I'd like to look at the Sanskrit here and go into it a little more closely. Machitta. Chitta is a Sanskrit word meaning the mind or consciousness. If you've heard of the Yoga Sutras, Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which are kind of popular nowadays, the Yoga Sutra. Sutra, by the way, sutra in Sanskrit means thread, and it is cognate with, that means historically, it is related to our English word suture, like stitch. So the Sanskrit word sutra is thread. It means a very like super condensed little saying that's often hard to fathom, and you need a commentary and so on. Like the Buddhists, what do they call them, koans? So on. So, in the Yoga Sutras, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali begin with the statement, Atha Yoga Anushasanam. Now the traditional teaching of yoga, Atha Yoga Anushasanam. And then the next statement is, a definition of yoga. Because if you say we're going to teach yoga, well, what is it? And so the next sutra, the next pithy little super condensed statement, gives a definition of yoga as yoga's chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga means to stop the mind basically from going off the rails. What does it mean? Well, it doesn't technically say off the rails, but that's the idea. Yoga's chitta vritti nirodha. The idea is that consciousness is meant to see things accurately. For example, I'm wearing glasses right now, which you probably noticed. So if my glasses are clean, if they're transparent, I can see clearly. But if my glasses are, you know, caked over with something, I can't see. So the same way consciousness needs to be transparent. If your consciousness is transparent, you can see what's really out there. Your consciousness is contaminated or polluted. It's like the sky in Los Angeles, you could say. I mean, you can be right in front of a mountain and not see it on some days. So, or for that matter, you can just go to Phoenix and witness that same phenomenon. So, the idea here is that the mind goes off the rails. It goes into illusion. For example, it is a scientific fact that not a single person in this room is actually the center of the universe. This may come as a crushing disappointment to someone here, but the fact is that we are actually very tiny. We are very tiny beings. And so if my mind goes into vanity, if my mind goes into self-centeredness, and it's going away from reality into illusion, and of course it's possible to live one's entire life in a type of illusion, or delusion, where, you know, we're still functional, you can drink water and tie your shoelaces and even maybe get a job. But there's a type of functional insanity, where even though on one level we are functioning in the world, we're actually seeing things in a way which is obviously not the way it really is. So the reason I brought up this little point of yoga is because the definition of yoga given in the Yoga Sutras, the first point talks about chitta. It doesn't talk about your legs or arms or, you know, anything like that. The first point of yoga is your consciousness. It's really about consciousness, not just about your stretching your legs and arms or, you know, sort of an organic tummy tuck or something. It's really about consciousness, about the way you see the world. So, that same word chitta, consciousness, is found here in this verse. And what Krishna says is that the way to purify your consciousness so you see things as they really are is that one should think of God. One should think of God. Why? Because the definition of God, or the Absolute Truth, which is given in another famous sutra literature called Vedanta, the definition of God is janmadhyasya tataha. God is the source of everything. God is the source of everything. So if you actually understand God, and everything is part of God, you understand everything. It's philosophically, you could say it's philosophical one-stop shopping. If you understand God, because everything is coming from God, everything is part of God, then you understand everything. And so therefore, Krishna here, speaking as God, says, machitta, that those who are advanced spiritually have their consciousness on me. Because, I mean, it's funny. For example, right now, I could not be thinking about, let's say, someone that lives in Milwaukee. I mean, obviously, many people live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm not one of them. I guess that weather is an acquired taste. But anyway, I mean, there's all kinds of people in the world, in Milwaukee and Green Valley and everywhere. And if you don't think about them, it doesn't mean that you're an illusion. You may just not know those people. So the fact that you are not thinking about some particular fact in the world, you may not be thinking about the Civil War right now, or Mars, or whatever. So there's all kinds of things. You don't have to think about them. You don't have to be conscious of them. It doesn't mean you're not a good person. It doesn't mean you're not intelligent. You're just not thinking about that right now. But if you don't think about God, it's different. Now, why is it different? Is it because God is jealous and so, you know, he's like that cosmic, crazy uncle in the attic? So that if, you know, God has, I don't know, self-esteem issues or anger management issues, and so if you don't think about God, you may do something harmful to you. It's not that. It's if you take seriously this idea, if you take seriously this idea that God is the source of everything, and also, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Maya Tatvidam Sarvam, that I pervade this universe, if we're not thinking about God, we are really misunderstanding everything. Whereas you may not be thinking about me, or I may not be thinking about you, it doesn't mean we misunderstand everything, it's just we're thinking about other things. But if we don't think about God, we're somehow misunderstanding everything, because the real identity of everything is that it's part of God. The reality of everything is that it comes from God, and therefore if we're not thinking about God, we are missing the boat. We're just not getting it. So, for example, just to give a very common example, let's say someone is completely oblivious to their own life history. I mean, practically everyone is, let's say, imperfectly raised by their parents. I mean, I was very lucky to have very loving parents, and I'm sure many of you have very loving parents, but it's hard to have parents who have perfect parenting skills. It doesn't happen so often. So all of us, in a sense, are, to some extent, products of our upbringing. We have a background, we have a history. And so if someone is just completely oblivious to that, has absolutely no clue about their own history, or never thinks deeply about why they are the way they are, or how am I behaving. In other words, there's no power of self-observation. Just whatever I'm doing, that's perfect because it's me and I'm perfect, and I'm perfect because I'm better than everybody else, so no one else's opinion about me counts. Only my opinion about myself counts, and I think I'm the greatest. Very light state of consciousness. So the idea here is knowing the history. For example, if you want to know why is America the way it is today, or why is China the way it is today, or why is India, or why is Germany the way it is today, there's a history. Things have a history. And so in the same way, the history of everything is that it originally came from God, from Krishna. That's the ultimate history of everything. And so, anyway, so what does Krishna say here? In this verse, Krishna, speaking as God, the only person practicing the world that can do that and not be committed to some asylum, you know, because he actually is God. So Krishna says, Madchitta Madgata Prana. Prana, those of you who dabble in yoga know the word prana. It means the vital energy, or the vital breath, prana. So Krishna says, one whose very life literally has gone to me. This is sort of an idiomatic expression in Sanskrit. One whose life is dedicated to me, and or those whose lives are dedicated to me, those whose minds are with me. And then Krishna says, bodhayanta parasparam. They enlighten one another. I'm sure you've heard of Buddhism. And the word Buddhism comes from the word Buddha. Probably no one ever thought of before. I'm probably the first person ever discovered that. So the word Buddha in Sanskrit is a, I know you'll be very interested in this, it's a past passive participle, which actually means the word Buddha really means the enlightened one or the awakened one. The verb bud means to awaken or to enlighten or to be enlightened. So here, Krishna uses the same word, the same verb in another case. He says, bodhayanta parasparam, which in Sanskrit, it means that people who are Krishna conscious, people who are conscious of God, enlighten one another. They enlighten one another. So this enlightenment is actually sort of a team sport. We can, you know, it's just like, let's say two people are working out together, so they help each other work out and get stronger. People can help each other, I don't know, do their homework. And so in the same way, we can actually help, we can enlighten one another. We can, and this is the best kind of friendship, where people help each other to be enlightened, to understand things. I mean, and enlightenment is not just some mystic thing, and someone could say, I'm not into mysticism, or I'm not into that kind of thing. But it's really, it's not just whether or not you're into mystic stuff. It's whether you're into sanity or not. I mean, some people are totally not into sanity. In fact, they find it kind of threatening. And so they keep themselves always more or less insane, either through drugs or through self-delusion. And so some people actually are not attracted by the concept of sanity because they feel that to be sane is to see the world as it is, and the world's not a nice place, so why even look at it? I mean, it's like ignorance is bliss. Ignorance is bliss, so it's better not to be too sane about the world, not to see it too accurately. But in fact, if you really see the world as it is, apart from all the bizarre things humans are doing, but if you really see the world as it is, it's actually very beautiful. It's actually extraordinary because people are obviously doing bad things in the world every day, but they're doing that within a system which will gradually correct them. And the world itself, the existence itself, the earth itself, the solar system, the galaxy, these things are actually divine creations, ultimately, of God. So, I mean, imagine if someone in your family, as they say, God forbid, if someone in your family actually had some kind of mental breakdown or really went off. And then everyone in the family is really hoping this person can come back to their senses and have a normal, productive life. Well, normal, productive life may not seem too attractive, but, you know, just come to the point of being sane. So when we are not God conscious, of course, you know, the valley of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, you've heard that. And even within insane asylums, there are, you know, there are communities of people who are not altogether healthy mentally, but they have their own communities and they have their own hierarchies and they have their own rules and, you know, they live in their own world. So we're something like that, although we constantly get validated by other people because, you know, we all tell each other that we're okay or that we're sane. In fact, from an enlightened point of view, from a spiritual point of view, we are all in a strange situation. Like, for example, as Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, our real identity is not the body, our real identity is the soul. And there's a very simple proof of this, or a very simple, you could say, demonstration, anecdotal demonstration of this, which Krishna gives in the Bhagavad Gita. You can very easily see that you, when you look in the mirror, you're not seeing yourself. You're just seeing, a virtual reality machine. You're just seeing something that's covering you. You have a job to do? The example Krishna gives in the Bhagavad Gita is, all of us have experience of childhood, right? Was anyone here born like 12 or 30? So we all have experience of being little children. And now, I mean, we're not little children. Well, if there's any little child in the room, I don't want to. Okay, so no one here is a little child. Now, our body didn't just stretch. It's not that you had a little child's body and it just stretched into the body you have now. The fact is that we are constantly reincarnating, you know, carne, flesh. So we are reincarnating all the time. Our skin if you, how long does it take for the skin to like to get a new skin? About 2 weeks, isn't it? It's like if, for example, I mean, one time I got poison, I can't remember if it was poison or poison ivy, but it was whatever it was bad. And it takes 2 weeks for the skin just to be replaced, because the poison ivy or the poison oak actually bonds to the skin. It bonds to the skin, and therefore you just have to kind of shed that skin to get rid of it, or nuke it, antibiotics. So it's funny, because if you think about sensuous life, like sex appeal and all that, I mean, it's a lot about skin. Skin is it's definitely one of the major organs in skin. The skin is an organ. Skin is really has a lot to do with what we consider being attractive, and, you know, there's like thousands of skin products in the marketplace. Anyway, so, I mean, typically if one person is attracted to another and touches their skin, especially in certain places, people get very excited about that. People, you know, skin really excites people somehow. And yet, that skin, you know, we replace it every 2 weeks. So if you, let's say, you know, had a conquest, sometimes words like that are used. If you touch someone's skin, and somehow in a situation that you found exciting, and then you see the person 2 weeks later, it's actually a different body. I mean, it's actually a different skin. And the hair is the same way. The hair, you know, comes and goes. And approximately, as you know, as they say, within 7 years, is that still the number?
As far as I know.
Yeah. Within 7 years, you totally reincarnate. So if you're, let's say if you're 14 years old, you've already had two complete reincarnations, literally, because the word carne means flesh. And so you've had two complete reincarnations. If you're 21, three, and anyway, it's all grammar school math. So what this means is, well, here's another fact. Even though we've reincarnated several times, and some of us may not want to reveal how many reincarnations we've had in this life, but even though we've reincarnated so many times, we're still the same person, right? I mean, a little linguistic anthropology here. It's very common to say, and we all say, when I was a child, when I was 2 years old, you know, I bit my sister's toe or something. You know, or when I was three, when I was five, when I was seven. So you acknowledge, you understand that it was you, but it's not the same body. So if one thing is the same and something else is changing, they're not equal. Right? This is very, very simple. The body's constantly changing. There's constantly new bodies. The self, you're the same person. You were one, you were two, three, five, seven, nine, 11, whatever. So you're the same person. It's not the same body. This is not rocket science. It's very simple. We are not the body. Obviously, there is a person. There is a person. The person who says, I was 1 year old, I was 2 years old, I was three, I was 10, 15. The person who's saying that is not the body. Because the person who says that is experiencing many different bodies. And therefore, a civilization which is based almost entirely on the body is a little clueless. If you look at, you know, go on the internet, of course, one of the main internet categories in this country is, surprise, surprise, pornography. But anyway, if you look, newspapers, that's kind of like 20th century. If you just look everywhere at media, if you look at stores, whatever people, it's all about the body. Now, we are not body haters. We are not body haters. We believe in being healthy, taking care of your body, you know, being actually very healthy. And just, however, it doesn't mean we are the body. Someone may take care of their car, it doesn't mean I am the car. You don't have to think I am something to care about it. For example, I care about other people, but I'm not them. So it's not a question of hating the body, or, you know, Hare Krishna don't, at night they don't go into their little rooms and whip themselves or anything. Try to drive the lust out of their bodies. It's just a simple fact. It's just a simple fact that we are not the body. And we're actually something better. This should not disappoint anyone, because we're actually something much greater. If we were the body, we would be time-bound. We would have to die. Just as the body is born, the body will die, the body gets diseased, it gets old, you know, all kinds of things happen. So, I mean, imagine a science fiction movie where, let's say, someone was hit by some kind of cosmic ray or something, and suddenly they looked in the mirror and started aging. You know, their body started morphing, and within 15 seconds they went from like 21 years old to 83 or something. You know, some science fiction movie. But the thing is, if it happens slow enough, no one realizes it's science fiction. Or it's science nonfiction or something. But that's what's actually happening. The body is morphing constantly. In fact, there was an ancient Greek philosopher named Heraclitus. Heraclitus? Two sound people. Anyway, so Heraclitus is famous for... Heraclitus is famous for saying that you can't step in the same river twice. The second time you step in the river, it's a different river, because the water you stepped in is gone, there's new water. So he's famous. He was trying to say this world is constantly in flux. So he said you can't step in the same river twice. And you could say just as well, you cannot breathe twice in the same body. You cannot take two breaths in the same body. Because the second time you breathe, some cells, some parts of your body are gone, and there's some new... So it's constantly in a state of flux. Therefore, well, taking care of the body and keeping it healthy and strong and all that, we really need to focus on ourselves. People nowadays are trying to be self-centered. They're not even making it. People are trying to be egoistic, and they're even failing at that. The Greek word ego... Actually, from the Sanskrit word aham. Let's change the H to a G. The Greek word ego is just the first person singular pronoun. I. It just means I. Ahankar, egoism, by the way. So to trying to be... In other words, if you want to focus on yourself, you want to take care of yourself, you have to know who you are. It's like someone who says, I'm hungry, I want to feed myself, and they keep putting the food in someone else's mouth. They keep missing their own mouth. I mean, it's a silly example, but who are we? And it turns out that we are part of God, as I said earlier. So now, Prabhupada, the Bhagavatam, this other scripture of the Bhagavatam, gives this brilliant analogy. It's very simple. The Sanskrit is yatha taror mula nishechanena. Just like, or just as, by watering the root of the tree. You water the root of the tree. You don't climb up in a tree with a squirt gun and try to water. You know, you could have some egalitarian notion, you know, like the French, égalité, equality. So why should the root hog all the water? So you can go up in the tree and squirt every leaf and twig and branch, but trees don't drink that way. That's a funny word for tree in Sanskrit. I mean, there's hundreds of words for tree in Sanskrit, but one of them is padapa, which literally means foot drinker. Padapa, because trees drink through their feet, through the roots. So just as a tree, a plant, necessarily drinks through its roots, that's just the way they drink. In the same way, there is a root to our existence. We are not the root of our own existence. We are not self-existing, self-manifesting wonders. There is actually a root to our existence. And we come from that root, and that root is God. And so if someone is not nourishing their relationship with God, they're actually starving themselves. The other example it's given is pranopahara jitendriyana. We have to put food in the stomach. You can't... I mean, that's where the food goes. Food, you have to put it into your mouth, it goes to the stomach. The stomach distributes the food to the rest of the body. That's just the way it works. So in the same way, if we try to please ourselves, of course that's the best, quickest way to be unhappy, as people eventually learn, is just living for yourself. That's the easiest way to be very unhappy. Because it's like a hand that refuses to give the food to the mouth and the stomach. It just wants to eat the food by itself, and the hand starves. So if we refuse to love, or we just don't, are not interested in serving or loving God, we are actually starving our own consciousness. Because we're part of God. And so it's like Prabhupada said, it's like the hand that refuses to give the food to the stomach. So we really are the authors of our own suffering. Anyway, Krishna says here, this verse says that tushanti cha ramanti cha, the way to be satisfied and happy, first of all, choose your friends wisely. We should choose friendship with people whose friendship is actually beneficial to us. It's just like a sane person will put in their mouth something which is actually healthy. Like, why would you put something else in your mouth unless, for whatever reason, you're self-destructive? And being self-destructive is not a healthy state of consciousness. It's a type of dementia. So, we should choose association, we should choose friendship with those people whose friendship actually will make me happy, will benefit me, because that friendship will lead me to a higher state of consciousness, not to a lower state of consciousness. And here Krishna talks about this satsanga that I was discussing earlier, where people enlighten one another. And Krishna says, Katyantaschamangakam, always speaking about me. So spiritual association, spiritual company is very important. Because we know, as they say, a person is known by the company they keep. So we are inevitably influenced by the people we hang out with. You really can't avoid them. It's like saying, I'm going to pour water on this cloth, but the cloth won't get wet. It won't be affected. If you think about it, water, fire, the elements affect each other. And so we affect each other. Inevitably, we affect each other. We just can't avoid it. Therefore, we should choose association with those who will help us to become Krishna conscious. That's the purpose of this community here, of course, is to provide an opportunity for spiritual friendship. That's really the purpose of it. Anyway, I've spoken on various points. Any questions on these points? No refunds. Yes?
The analogy of the ghost and the machine, which the soul and the body are both a paradox. In the spiritual world, what would the soul look like?
Okay. First of all, the word ghost, if I can just lead into it that way. The word ghost, of course, is obviously related to the German word Geist. English is a Germanic language, der Geist, which means spirit. So the word ghost has a background, that word has a background, meaning something like spirit, mind, consciousness. Therefore, in Christianity, for example, they talk of the Holy Ghost, doesn't mean like, St. Casper. The Holy Ghost is, in that sense of it, like spirit. So there is a Geist. There is a spirit in the machine. And what does the soul look like in the spiritual world? Soul is very beautiful. I mean, as much as we kind of lather cosmetics on our bodies or whatever, it's funny, in Southern California, if you look especially like areas of West LA, Beverly Hills, look at the phone book, and there's a whole section for cosmetic surgery. So, this whole thing about, cosmetic surgery and beauty products, which, anyway, I won't make a comment. The point is that all of us are far, far, far more beautiful than we can imagine. What we see in the mirror, what was that, Brother Grimm, Brothers Grimm, Spieglein, Spieglein an der Wand, mirror, mirror on the wall, that's the original version. So, we are all just unimaginably beautiful because we're part of God. And so at the present time, we are literally degrading ourselves, because a grade means like a level, right? A grade. And so we are degrading. We are somehow attached to an idea of ourselves, which is much, much less than what we really are. What we really are, because we're part of God. And God is infinitely beautiful, and we're part of that. We are a part of infinite beauty. And so if we can sort of, you know, forget about cosmetic surgery, Chandra and Krishna, and try to revive our pure consciousness. Yes?
So the understanding is that Krishna came in his body, which is his spiritual body, and which appeared to us, to our material eyes. And so also everybody has their own spiritual body, like Krishna has his spiritual body and Goloka Vrindavan.
Yes. We all have sort of like inconceivably beautiful eternal forms. And in the spiritual world, there's love, there's friendship. This world is a reflection. If you know Platonic and Neoplatonic thought, anyway, won't go into that for now. But the idea is that, let's say you're on the bank of a lake. Not a lot of lakes, I guess, in this part of the country. But let's say, imagine a lake. And let's say you're on the bank of a lake, and it's a still lake, you know, there's no wind, and so the water is very calm. And you see a tree reflected in the water. That reflected tree is almost identical to the real tree in appearance, but it's just a reflection. Now imagine a hungry person who's trying to eat the reflected fruits in the water. You know, this person, let's say, doesn't know there's a real tree there. And so this person, somehow their eyes can only see the reflected tree, and they keep reaching into the water and trying to eat those fruits and never quite getting them. That's our situation. We keep reaching out into the material world, trying to find satisfaction, and it doesn't exactly happen. I mean, we have our moments, and there are even states like it being very like nervous anticipation, sometimes taken as joy. And often after you know a long time of nervous anticipation, there's the nervous event itself, and then there's the looking back on it. So that's the situation. The reason this world looks so real is because it is, in one sense, a close reflection of a real world. That's why we're getting faked out. Yes. Okay.
Wait, go ahead.
You two can fight it out among yourselves, right?
Oh, okay.
I mean, or discuss it amicably.
To you, is an essence celibacy? Is it supposed to, in the thought of celibacy, is there a problem with pornography and self-pleasuring, or is it celibacy supposed to be the end of gratification to yourself? I know I ask these questions that are like, whoa. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, imagine if someone you love buys you a box of organic natural candies. And then out of gratitude, you buy them a box, but then you eat it all yourself. Don't even give it to the person. That's a little piggish. And so, God, Krishna, has given us life, has given us everything, and so we have this body, and it's natural to reciprocate. To take this great gift of a body, this gift of life, and then make an offering back, to offer back. There's a beautiful song by George Harrison, in which one of the lines is, you know, we're forgetting to give back. So there's a natural cycle, which Krishna describes in the Gita, Evam Pravarti Tan Chakram, where we are receiving so much and we offer back. If I just receive everything, and I just want to gluttonously enjoy everything and I give nothing back. So the body, which is a gift, can be used for loving reciprocation, to serve God. And if we, as you put it, which is kind of a nice, delicate way of putting it, self-pleasuring.
I don't.
No, that's an elegant way to express something which is not very elegant, but in terms of self-pleasuring, we are pleasure-seeking creatures, you could say. And it's natural that we be in a state of happiness. Seeking satisfaction in that way, it's not just that it's like evil and all that, it's just misguided, because that's not the way to get real happiness. If by, let's say, inducing sexual pleasure in yourself, if that actually gave real happiness, then everybody should do it. If it were a fact that that produces real happiness, then everyone should do it. The question is that actually the source of real lasting happiness or not? And of course, in a sense, it's relative, because it depends on what you've experienced. For some people, that may be the greatest pleasure they've ever experienced. That's the best thing they have going for them in their life. So the emphasis in Krishna consciousness is not on giving things up, and you can't do that. You know, it's like your guru, someone that comes around, just wraps your knuckles all day. You know, as if you were an infant child. The emphasis is not on give up this, give up that, that's nasty, ooh, you can't do that. That's not the emphasis. The emphasis is on experiencing a higher pleasure. The emphasis is, and then you just outgrow the other stuff. For example, when I was young, I think like most kids, I had all these toys, and I really liked my toys, and then I just sort of outgrew them. It's not that someone came and gave me a sermon, preached to me, give up your board games, give up your, you know, give up your this, give up your that, give up your toys. No one preached to me to give up my toys, I just outgrew them. And so the emphasis is on positively practicing bhakti yoga, Krishna consciousness, and you simply outgrow those things. You just experience something hundreds of times more interesting and more satisfying. So that's secret spiritual life, outgrowing this stuff. Maybe just here, and then you, and then we'll go back to you. Yes, did you want to ask something?
Yes. Yesterday, I think we were kind of all asking some questions after, and I think you had made a, you were just referring to a walk that you took yesterday, a 6-mile walk, and I think you had said something about the enjoyment of seeing Krishna everywhere. And can you talk a little bit about what that looks like to you? I mean, I can envision what thinking about Krishna is sometimes, or I can, if I'm walking and I look at a tree, I may say, oh, tree, or then I may think of some mental or intellectual thing.
Right.
But, and then there's periodically, there's like maybe once every couple hours or every couple years or something, I'll just say, wow, that looked really neat. You know, and that was kind of just a great experience. So are you saying that when you walk and you seek, what does that look, what is that, can you elaborate on saying,
sure,
walking for 6 miles and seeing Krishna everywhere?
Yeah, I'll elaborate. As you were speaking, I thought of an example. Imagine that you love someone very much. It can be a brother, a sister, just someone that's very, very close to you. And let's say that person has a little child. You know, someone you love very much as a child. As soon as you see that child, you feel love. I think back when I was a little kid, that the friends of my parents, my father's friends, my mother's friends, they were very affectionate to me. Aunts and uncles. It's not like, you know, when you're a little kid, if you, you know, have a good family, it's not that your aunts and uncles come over and kind of figure out whether or not they like you. Let's say you're not a monster, you're just a, you know, little kid. So what I want to say is that everything is coming from Krishna. And so...
Okay, let me follow up on that. That's
sure,
my
sure.
answer. And okay. I think I understand what you're saying.
I was going to go beyond that, but go ahead.
Okay. You can... I have two children, and
yes.
I know exactly what you're saying. When I look at my children, I see that. But I don't see that when I'm... I mean, I don't see that when I'm thinking of Krishna. I don't feel that. So how do you...
Well, because, I mean, when we're walking, every tree, Krishna's not... But let's say you're taking a walk, and you see birds, or you see trees, or other humans. Every living thing you see is family. There is no living thing that is not your family. And so it's like just going out walking the street. Everywhere you go is like this big happy family reunion. Now, the other people may not quite understand that. But still, it's still so that, so as far as living things, and even things like cement or, you know, rubber garden hoses, of course that's really out of date, right? They don't make garden hoses out of rubber anymore. Anyway, it's like everything we see is the energy of God, whether it's earth or water, or air, or fire. And every living being is our family.
Sentient, non-sentient.
Yeah, exactly. Conscious and unconscious. Every living thing is family. And therefore, you see, for example, let's say, I mean, do you have any brothers or sisters or nieces or nephews?
Brothers and sisters. Or sisters, two sisters.
Yeah. Any nieces or nephews?
Nieces or no, none of them have any kids.
Oh. Okay. Imagine you have a niece or nephew. It's like, when you see them, it's special. Because it's, you know, when you see, like say you see your sisters, it's your sisters. And so naturally there's a special consciousness when you see them. So, and like whenever someone in your family has a baby, you always say it's beautiful, whatever it is. You always say it's beautiful. And I suppose in a sense people really, you know, it looks beautiful. But the idea is when you see everything as part of God, when you see everything as part of God, everything becomes very beautiful. Everything. I mean, a stone or plastic bags.
The kid was the bag.
Yeah, there's this huge plastic bag storage facility, which used to be called the Pacific Ocean. But actually, everything is God's energy, and every person is your family, intimately your family. Every living thing is your family. Because, so when you walk, and Krishna's personally present. Because when you understand Krishna, how beautiful he is, how attractive he is, and then everywhere you look, you realize that Krishna's there. He's actually present. And the more you become Krishna conscious, you see this. It's like the dawn where there's more and more light. You see things more and more. I'm sorry, this lady, and then you?
Thank you. I was going to ask, can you say something about the concept of the lotus feet? Like, Sean here was bringing up, what does our spiritual body look like? And, you know, we talk about Krishna's spiritual body, and oftentimes the different parts of the body will use those to represent different ideas, and so the concept of taking shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord. Can
right.
you just say something about that?
Yeah. It doesn't literally mean that Krishna or other pure souls have flowers at the end of their legs. In India, the lotus flower was considered to be very beautiful. In fact, it is very beautiful. If you've seen it, it's a very beautiful thing. And so, the word lotus, there's so many words for lotus, just like the Middle East and ancient, in traditional Arabic, there were dozens of words for camel. But in India, they have all these words, it's true, they have all these words for lotus. And so to say that something is lotus, like, it's interesting because in Sanskrit, although we say in English lotus feet, like the lotus feet of the guru or the lotus feet of Krishna, in Sanskrit, it's usually, the word order is inverted. They'll usually say the foot lotus, like Chaturnaravinda, the foot lotus. And so it's really just a way of saying that something is beautiful, that something is sublime. It's like the suffix deva, like guru deva or this deva or that deva. It's which literally it means divine, deva, divine. And so it's just a way of saying spiritual. Because, say, in Indian culture, well, the word guru meant teacher. So there are wrestling gurus, and there are cooking gurus, and there are, you know, there's gurus for everything because guru is a teacher. But if you mean specifically what we call a spiritual teacher, then you say guru deva, which means it's a spiritual teacher, not just a teacher. So the same way lotus, so there's these different suffixes, which are used in Sanskrit, and so the word lotus just comes to mean beautiful, sublime. I think that's it. Yes?
Two things. Hershey's mentioned the lotus. Some people feel that all they want to do constantly is look at the Lord's lotus feet. And that's a way of... But back to him, when he was speaking of the soul, it's the same thing Arjuna had that problem. You know, he didn't, on the battlefield, if you recall, he did not want to fight. He did not want to, because he thought he would be damaging his family, members of his family that were on the opposite side. But then Krishna cleared it and says, well, it's a fool who thinks that he can actually damage somebody. In other words, what he's trying to say is you can't tamper the soul. So don't confuse the body with the soul.
Yes.
The soul is what you're saying. And kind of like what he was going to say, well, you know, I can't see this. There's that separation between the body and the soul. It's what Krishna wanted to clear up with Arjuna. Well, you couldn't possibly hurt him anyway. You know, he goes, well, I'd rather just die right here and not be going with this fight if I got to kill my uncle, if I've got to kill my... You know, because you have things like that. You can't kill them anyway. I mean, in other words, this is nothing, actually.
But yeah. Also, to put it in his... Yeah, I mean, thank you for that. Also, to put it in a historical perspective, as we know, the Gita, Bhagavad Gita, Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita on a battlefield, and those were professional soldiers. Those weren't draftees or, you know, just farm boys that somehow ended up on a battlefield. Those were professional soldiers, and there were constitutional issues. The example, sometimes people ask, like, why is the Gita spiritual work spoken on a battlefield? The example I sometimes give it, imagine you woke up one morning and saw in the news that there was a coup d'etat, someone actually took over the government. Some dictator had taken over the government and suspended the constitution. If then, let's say people loyal to the Constitution, fought to reestablish constitutional government, most people would find that to be the right thing to do. I mean, most people would say, no, forget the Constitution, forget, you know, our rights and everything like that, let them have it. So, the Gita is a relatively short work, but it's within a much larger work, Mahabharata, and so that's the historical context. That Arjuna was fighting to reestablish a constitutional government. If you study the history of monarchy, what you find is that, well, now Alice Wonderland's coming out, you know, off with their heads.
Right.
Yeah, right. So we tend to have this image in America, especially in America, that you know, monarchy was always cruel and kings and queens were... We're actually a little schizophrenic and ambivalent about it, because on the one hand, kings and queens were all cruel and chop people's heads off. On the other hand, people go crazy when royalty comes to this country. So, the fact is that there is and was such a thing as constitutional monarchy, and then there was absolute monarchy, where there was no constitution, people had no rights. And the absolute monarchy was a relatively late phenomenon, which became especially prominent in the 1600s. People like Louis XIV and so on. But in any case, in India back then, at the time of Krishna and Arjuna, it was a constitutional monarchy, not an absolute monarchy. That's very clear from the text. And people also had freedom of speech, by the way. You could go and criticize the king as much as you wanted, and there was absolutely no punishment for that. People, they had freedom of speech. That's very clear in the text, in the ancient text. And so Arjuna and Krishna were fighting to reestablish the principle of law, the rule of law, not the rule of the rule by the whim of a tyrant. And of course, the word, the ancient Sanskrit word for law, is dharma, which means different things, but it's also the ancient Sanskrit word for law. So there is a historical context. Plus, what you said, of course, is the ultimate point, that we are spiritual beings. Yes?
The philosopher of Goethe, G-O-A-T-H-E, is that how you
pronounce it? G-O-E?
G-O-A-T-H-E, Goethe.
Goethe?
Goethe. I'm not good with German.
Isn't he? I think he's a writer, isn't he?
Yes. He said it's easy to think, hard to act. It's hard to act out what we think. That's one of his quotes. And in this age in particular, this is guilty of it. I feel incredibly guilty for some of the things I think. Don't act them out. But a lot of my friends, I feel guilty for thinking this, blah, blah, blah. I just recently stumbled upon one of Prabhupada, in the Back to Godhead magazine, that Prabhupada, should I get it right? He said that there's a special concession in the age of Kali Yuga for
mental acts. Yeah. I mean, people are not, there's no karma for mental acts, but if you really do something, then you're responsible for it.
When did that enter our, when did that happen?
Well, according to the Bhagavatam, Kali Yuga.
So sorry.
This age, last several thousand years. So if you act properly, but your mind is a little out of control, then there's still hope. Yes.
So is it that those who live in truth have to be challenged by the illusions that rise out of the material world?
Well, the purpose of bhakti yoga is, bhakti yoga empowers us to transfer ourselves to the spiritual world. And so you have to be tested. It's like before a car rolls off the, out of the factory into the showrooms of America. Well, it's supposed to be tested. I probably should have tested some of those Toyotas a little better. But the idea is that you don't want to go into the spiritual world and there you are with all these pure souls and whoops, I guess I really wasn't ready. Like buyer's remorse, maybe I can go. And so yes, you have to really be tested. You have to really be certain that this is what I want. I want the truth, I want God, I want myself. I want myself as I really am, as an eternal divine being. I really want that. And I've shopped around, I've gone through the whole consumer catalog of this universe. I've gone through the whole catalog of the universe. I know everything that's available for selfish pleasure of the universe, and I choose Krishna. I choose myself as a pure spiritual being. Otherwise, you may experience a sudden acceleration of your material desires. Yes, Gangya.
About that issue of enlightenment or seeing everything as beautiful, of course, it sounds like a very high state of consciousness and not so easy to just get there. I know the Bhagavad Gita gives us different examples where we can see God, the fish is on the shark, and different things like that, but is there some elaboration on that so maybe we can kind of like work our way up to that?
Well, it's like the sun rising. When they say the crack of dawn, the first light of dawn, you can see a little bit, and then it's a gradual process. As the sun moves toward the horizon, everything becomes revealed more and more until it becomes fully visible. You see the colors and so on. So that's the process of enlightenment. I know myself, when I first began this many years ago, I immediately experienced that I was coming to a higher state of consciousness. If you're sick, and you really feel lousy because you're sick, and you start to get better, even if you're not fully healthy, the experience of getting better is very encouraging. Isn't it? The experience of getting better, the experience of improving, is very encouraging. If you're learning a musical instrument, And you may not have mastered, let's say, a particular piece, but you're getting better at it. It's very enlightening. No problem. You need to go to the... It's one of the basic human rights. So when you start to advance to higher states of consciousness, that's thrilling. And we have to be really careful that Krishna consciousness doesn't just become our religion, that it remains for us a dynamic spiritual process. Because there's a tendency to settle down and this is my religion, rather than, you know, continuing to be a searching for God. We have all these Back to Godhead articles, you know, that in our magazine, people often write articles, how I discovered Krishna consciousness, and usually it's, I was looking for God or something. And the point I always try to make is that we're still searching for God. Prabhupada gave us a perfect roadmap, but we're still searching for God. And even the six Goswamis, Hey Rad, Hey Brajadevi, Hey, you know, Vrindavan. So we should be enthusiastic, determined seekers of the highest spiritual truth, rather than just settling down into sort of a, you know, comfort thing where this is my religion. Okay, I've got my religion. I've answered the important questions in life. Now I can just kind of kick back and, you know, whatever, live my life. We have to remain spiritual seekers. So, there's another question, I think. Yes, there is another question.
This morning we had a nice discussion about chanting, and you gave some nice examples, because many congregation members also chant a little bit. And could we just have a little more discussion about that?
Sure.
You're talking about, you know, we get what we put into it. And...
Oh, chanting. Yeah, it's Krishna's present in his name. And I discussed that the other night, about that idea of God's present in his name. And so, when we chant the name of God, we are really associating with God. So, how do you like to be treated when you show up somewhere? It's like if someone invites you to their home, and then you arrive there, and they don't have time for you, it's like, why did you invite me? Because you don't have time for me, you're not really paying any attention to me, you just told me to come to your house. So, when we chant the name of God, God appears. And so, it's like, knock, knock, who's there? I mean, like, what is it? So, we're chanting, and we shouldn't chant, it's like, I'm not so happy, so I'm going to use the holy name as like a pill. It's better than popping pills, just pop the name. I mean, it is better, but... We should really remain conscious that it's a person. The name of God is a person. It's God. And so when we chant the name of God, Harinam, we are directly in a relationship, and we should be ladies and gentlemen with the holy name. We need to constantly remind each other because... Yes.
But the more you chant, you will... I guess it's like, but it's not like you put money in the bank. That's a bad analogy. But the more you chant, the more.
Yeah, it is spiritual money in the bank. Yeah.
It feels like money. The more you chant, the more God will bless you. The more you will feel like doing it. The more you do it, the more it'll become you. And
yes, and then
it will become you. It'll be you. You'll have an answer.
No, that's true. But there's actually there are like, what do they say, golf sand traps and, you know, things like that. Because consider the nature of repetition of anything. Just consider the nature of repetition. For example, let's say you're practicing your routine for some Olympic event. And so you go over and over and over and over and over it. Or let's say, for example, you're appearing on stage, live theater. And so you rehearse your lines over and over and over again. Because the more you repeat something, the more you can do it without thinking about it. let's say you're like practicing a musical piece. You just play it over and over and over again until your fingers just go where they're supposed to go. And so we have to practice spiritual life in order to get good at it, but repetition also can bring about a certain unconsciousness. It's very interesting. There's like this tension between, repetition as enhancement and refinement and getting good at something, and repetition as a way of sort of dulling yourself. You can almost do it in your sleep. And so how do we repeat the chanting, constantly chant, repeat bhakti yoga, but not become dull, not take it for granted? I mean, I've seen priests in every tradition, certainly including this one, where they just kind of like rattle off the prayers, a bunch of they've done it a million times, and I've seen it in every religion. It's not like this or that religion. It's just so to repeat it and get really good at it, at the same time be always alive to it. Could you possibly do that at some other time? Thank you. So, any other question? If not, the highlight of our program, free food. Yes?
I did have a question. If you start finding yourself, you're chanting and you're going unconscious, you're just rattling it off. I usually stop.
Right. Yeah, sure, time out.
And do something else.
Yeah, the people have different strategies. And so, you'll find what works for you. That may be one thing, just go, just sort of stop for a second and become conscious again. And that happens in relationships. Sometimes, like the two people, they're just taking each other for granted. So why don't we just, let's just stop. Like, I'll go here, you go there. Maybe, a few hours, let's meet again and see if we can treat each other like human beings. So, yeah, that's one way to do it. Sometimes you take a time out. Sometimes a team, the team's playing really badly, the coach calls a timeout just to stop the downward momentum. So,
thank you, Maharaj.
Thank you.
Received our little email today. Maharaj has very kindly agreed to stay a little longer. So yeah. He'll be speaking here, same time, same place tomorrow, 6:30.
Yeah, a little late today. There was a sort of an information glitch. Otherwise, I would have been on time.
So you'll be here tomorrow?
Yeah.
Yeah, he'll be here tomorrow, 6:30. We'll have a little chanting for 15 minutes before, and then Maharaj will be speaking. And then on skipping a day, giving him a little chance. He's doing some translating and some writing. And on Friday, we'll be having a home program at Gangaya Prabhu's house.
Oh, Gangaya's house.
Which
out on the west side.
Out on the west side, which
West Side Story.
RSVP. And then again on Sunday, Maharaj will be speaking and giving our Sunday festival lecture, which starts at 5:30, and he'll be speaking at 6:00.
I'd like to thank Sandamini. Everyone knows and loves Sandamini.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, we do have some prasadam, but because of the restaurant still going on, we're going to probably serve plates out and bring it in here. So, if I could have a couple devotees to help me. And then we can do that. So, thank you. Here's probably one.
Yeah. And if anybody needs directions to my place, just see me. Okay.
Lalita.